This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum and also of Humanities West. And I'd like to welcome you to Humanities West Presents at the Commonwealth Club. This is our fourth program post-pandemic. We had a pause between our usual programs and these. And it's really great to see some of our old friends, our old patrons, here tonight. Again, we have a special thing, a special program tonight, and this was one of the kind of things that we're trying to move a little bit towards. This was suggested by one of our old patrons, Tom Duffy. He saw that the Ramses the Great exhibit was coming to the D. Young Museum and said, why don't you guys do a program on that while the museum is having their displays, their exhibit. So we did. And anybody else who's a friend of Humanities West, if you have an idea like that, just send it to us. You can use our website, humanitieswest.org, which we've completely re-updated and contains all 40 years of our programs. So thanks to Tom Duffy for making that suggestion. I'd also like to mention that the Commonwealth Club, who we are partnering with on these programs, has a travel agency, and they do tours to Egypt. And I think that they've got another one coming up, which I heard is sold out. But in any case, they do them fairly regularly. So that's another possibility if you really find this as exciting as we expect you to, because it's not really that common at all to be able to see the kind of artifacts from ancient Egypt that we have at the De Young Museum. It's really, really rare. So without any further ado, we're going to go right to Renee Dreyfuss from the De Young Museum, who is going to tell us about this exhibit and what's showing. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. I wonder if any of you have seen the show already. There we go. Yay! I have to admit, it was not easy going to bring the objects to San Francisco. But when I saw what the object list was going to be, I fought and happy to do so, because the show looks just gorgeous in our De Young galleries. I want to say that it is really appropriate for me to be here tonight and speak to you, because this is the occasion of the centenary of the discovery of Tutankhamun's opening of the tomb, the discovery, Howard Carter's. I don't know how many of you knew that. I mean, it's been in the press. They're making a big deal of it. But in fact, this is 100 years since Howard Carter discovered the tomb. And I have to say, I am, I believe, the only curator who has been the curator of both King Tut exhibitions in San Francisco. Worldwide, probably I'm the only curator who has done two King Tut exhibitions. And the amazing thing about it is they were first in 1979, and then in 2009, and they opened exactly the same month in June, and it was precisely 30 years apart. Now, for the ancient Egyptians, 30 years after a king starts his rule, 30 years afterwards, he has something called a Sed festival, which is a wonderful festival that rejuvenates the king and gives him the power to go on and continue his pharaohship. After the gods have looked upon him with favor. So I thought, okay, 30 years to the month. This is perfect. This is my Sed festival. And from now on, I'm rejuvenated, and I'll start all over again. So So that's King Tut. But today I'm going to speak to you about Ramses II, who ruled for much longer than the boy king and accomplished much more in his life, so that we call him today Ramses the Great. And the exhibition opens. Those of you who've been in the exhibition know that it opens with this statue, the upper part of a colossal statue of Ramses, and he's wearing the crown of Upper Egypt. And the exhibition is a unique show. It explores the life and the accomplishments of a distinguished military officer who was a crown prince, Ramses the Great, under his father, Seti I. And when Seti I died, he eventually became the king of Egypt. And he is regarded as the most celebrated and the mightiest pharaoh of the new kingdom, which is Egypt's golden age, when it was wealthy and powerful. He was the third pharaoh of the 19th dynasty and was not only worshipped as a god during his lifetime, but was venerated far into the future. Ramses was born around 1300 BC, and he was considered the divine son of the god Amun. The story is that Amun visited his mother in the dark of the night, and as a result, Ramses was born. So he had an earthly mother and a divine father. So he ruled as a god in the eyes of his people for an incredibly long period of time. 66, 67 years, around 1279 to 1213 BC. And that was the second longest reign of any pharaoh. He lived for an astonishing 92 years, when the life expectancy of an ordinary Egyptian was more like 34 or 35 years. So you can see he lived a lot longer than Tut, and for that reason, he was pharaoh for a lot longer. For that reason, he was able to do so much more than Tut, who died at such a young age and was pharaoh for such a short time. When you see him in the exhibition, you'll see that he's wearing a crown of Upper Egypt, and other statues you see him wearing a different crown, the crown of Lower Egypt, showing that he was the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, that is, all of Egypt. And like many of the statues that you'll see of him all over Egypt, because he was, a megalomaniac, and you'll see more of his statues in Egypt than any other king. And in this case, it's a colossal head from an over-life-sized statue, and it was usurped from another king. Now, recarving a statue of another king with Ramses' image was a sign of divine authority. The king was the living god. He was Horus. And all of the rulers before him were also the living god Horus. After they died, they became Osiris. They went off to the afterlife to live with the gods, and they themselves were a god. But you know that smile, the round cheeks, the face is unmistakably Ramses. And you'll notice when you see his statues, there is a protruding brow, and he's looking right out at you. Consider how high up he must have been as a colossal statue, but he's looking at you from a position of on high, even though he has direct eye contact with you. So here you see this gorgeous bracelet with the Eye of Horus on it, because the exhibition also includes some of the most dazzling royal treasures ever seen in America. And this bracelet is one of my favorite. When you go there, you'll see a video where I describe it in detail. It was found on the mummy of a king named Sheshonq II, who ruled about 300 years after Ramses. And it's shown in lapis lazuli and carnelian and gold, the sacred eye of Horus, which was a complex symbol of protection and wholeness throughout Egyptian history. And it represents the eye. You can see it's like a falcon eye that the god Horus lost in the battle with his uncle Seth. And the god Thoth later put it back in. He restored the eye. And so it came to symbolize wholeness and healing. So one thing to say is that all of the objects are from Egyptian museums. And it's a state-of-the-art exhibition. And it lets visitors walk through to see some of these grand objects while viewing multimedia productions. So I'm hoping that those productions give you a deeper understanding and a greater context for the art on view. And by the way, there's also upstairs an immersive virtual reality experience. And there you have Nefertari, Ramses II, great royal wife, flying through Abu Simbel, the temples of Abu Simbel, and her own tomb, which is a gorgeous thing. And, I mean, how else can you show something about the massive architectural feats that were realized by Ramses the Great? So here you see Ramses as a sphinx. And showing it from the front and from the side. In the 6 decades of Ramses' reign, the Egyptian empire prospered as he secured and expanded the country's borders. And when he died, few remembered there was ever a time before he was their pharaoh. And you see him here as a sphinx. You have the king's head on a lion's body. From the front, you see on the left-hand side, you see him making an offering of a jar with a stopper, and the stopper has a ram's head. That is symbolic of the god Amun, or Amun-Re. And so he is worshiping, in fact, as a king, as a sphinx, he is worshiping. But from the side, if you only see the side, it's showing a beautiful lion's body. And I love it. You can see the ribs. You can see the ridge of his spine leading to the tail. You see the tail curled around. It's a beautiful rendition of a lion. But at the same time, it doesn't continue as a lion, and you see human hands making the offering. It's quite an extraordinary work of art. It's made of limestone, and I think the artist has done a remarkable job of merging two forms. Well, throughout his long period as a ruler, Ramses maintained an unprecedented construction campaign that guaranteed that future generations would know him as a great and a good ruler. And he was even a legend in his own time. I mean, you know, here he is creating out of the cliffs of Nubia this incredible temple. It was his sacred duty, he felt, to restore earlier monuments, which he did. Some of them had fallen into disrepair. And then he undertook construction throughout the land with buildings that would honor the gods and the king's predecessors leading up to him. So he left behind an unequal legacy of cities, buildings, temples, obelisks, colossal statues, and impressive written accounts proclaiming his famous exploits. And the exhibition has models of some of these great architectural feats, as well as photo blow-ups of several of these architectural wonders. And this, you know, is Ramses Temple at Abu Simbel, and it was carved into the limestone cliffs in northern Nubia, today's Sudan. And it is the largest of his temples in Nubia and one of the most iconic monuments in ancient Egypt. You know, each one of these statues that you're looking at is 60 feet high. And some people have called this an ego cast in stone, for obvious reason. I'm showing this slide from the 19th century that shows a man standing on his lap. It gives you some. Each one of these is about the height of a six-story building, let's say, and it's dedicated to the sun god Re Harakhti, as well as to Ramses II himself as a god. There's a central corridor, and you can see this better when you go into the exhibition, that runs from the entrance into a sanctuary in the back, some 200 feet. And then there are four statues in the back. And it is aligned to the sun's position at the spring and the fall equinox in February and October. And on those days, the sun shines into the front, and it lights up three of the four statues. It's amazing, amazing engineering feat for the ancients. And then, of course, you probably know that Lake Nasser, with the Aswan Dam, Lake Nasser was going to flood this area. So step by step, piece by piece, they dug up this temple and the temple of Nefertari right next to it and created a new cliff, and that's where it is today, and the sun still shines on those days into the inner sanctuary. Ramses also added to the temple of the temple complex of Karnak and the Luxor temple, and he commissioned the gigantic Ramesseum, his memorial temple in western Thebes, and many other buildings, far more than any other king had done before him. And the Ramesseum mortuary temple was called in Egyptian a mansion of millions of years. And it was the location for rituals that sustained the king's ka, or his life force. And that was where his cult would be carried out after his death. And the name Ramesseum was coined by Jean-François Champollion, the early 19th century scholar who first deciphered the hieroglyphic script. And that was in 1822, just 200 years ago. We have another celebration for that anniversary this year. And I thought that was really a good thing for us to have the Ramses exhibition during these two great anniversaries. Well, I really like the statue of Ramses because it's just, it seems to me more appealing. We're looking at him as a young man. And he's holding a heka scepter, which is a shepherd's crook, which was symbolic of kingship. After all, he shepherds his people. And we know that soon the name Ramses became synonymous with kingship. And in fact, nine pharaohs after him called themselves Ramses in his honor. And he is regarded as a ruler who came to epitomize power and wealth of ancient Egypt at its height. And in addition to that, remember he was a warrior, and remember he was always victorious, But as you'll see, he also secured peace with his neighbors. And, to this day, he's still considered the most outstanding and celebrated of the pharaohs, aptly known as Ramses the Great. So the statue we're looking at now is the upper part of what was a seated statue of Ramses. It's granodiorite, a very hard stone. And as I said, he's holding the symbol of kingship. And notice that round face. That is Ramses. Whenever you see these high cheekbones, slightly bulging almond-shaped eyes, and that sweet, sweet smile, there's a little drilling on either side of the mouth. In this statue, you're looking at Ramses as a forever youthful ruler. And notice in his right hand, he's wearing a bracelet with the sacred eye of Horus, very similar to the one we saw earlier. It was traditional, became a very, very common symbol to show health, healing, but also protection in this world and in the next. Of course, this isn't a visual likeness of the king, but an idealized image. We know it doesn't look like him at all because we have his mummy. And we know this isn't what his face looked like. They've been forensic portraits, and his face is quite angular. His nose was quite different than this. But this is the way he liked to have himself portrayed. Well, that statue was found in Tanis, which is a site in the Eastern Delta. But it probably represents a statue that was standing in a new capital city that Ramses created very near there in Per Ramses. You know, that means House of Ramses. Let's see if this works. There we go. Does it work? I'm not seeing it on the screen. There we are. There it is. And notice where Tanis is. Now, before this, the New Kingdom kings had their capital in Thebes. So you look when you see on the left-hand side in Upper Egypt, you see Karnak and Luxor. So he moved the capital into the Delta area, and that was probably the seat of where the Ramesses family comes from. So family roots there, also ability to fight some of the traditional enemies of Egypt that were up in the north. And when he created his capital, he had over 50 statues of himself placed throughout the cities. And some of the statues that he created of himself were larger than the statues of the gods that stood alongside them. So the statues from Per Ramses, ended up in Tanis after the branch of the Nile silted over in his capital city, and block by block, statue by statue, everything ended up in Tanis, which really then was the ultimate location of many of Ramses' statues and buildings. And at this time, it was about 150 years after Ramses created his capital city that they moved everything to the new city called Tanis. And we're going to see a lot of things from the pharaohs of the 21st dynasty. Now, remember, Ramses is 19th century dynasty. So 21st dynasty, when they created a new seat of power in Tanis. And in Tanis, the name of Ramses II continued, and he was known as the great ancestor. So one of our favorite things in the exhibition shows Ramses as a warrior. We've seen him as a builder. I might say he was a pretty good family man. He had over 100 children. We know of 8 wives. I don't know whether how many other wives to create 100. So he was a family man. He was a builder, and he was a great warrior. And here you see him. He is holding the hair of some of the traditional enemies of Egypt, and with one blow, he is about to smite them all. He repelled invasions by the Nubians from the south, the Libyans on the western frontier. There were pirates coming down from the Mediterranean, the sea peoples, and then the Hittites. Hittites came from Turkey, and then he fought them in the Syrian coast. So he was a mighty warrior king with an army estimated, can you believe this, to have totaled 100,000 men. And it was his most famous battle that we hear about, and you'll see a reenactment of it in the exhibition. It took place in Syria at a site called Kadesh, and it's on the Orontes River, and it was a trade route, and it was really important for the economic interests of both the Hittites in Turkey and the Egyptians. And they came down upon each other, and they fought in Kadesh. And he talks about it in many of his statues and his temples that he had erected in his own glory. So it's a multimedia reenactment, as I say. And it tells you about, it's so interesting. I mean, it tells you about spies and deception and intrigue, and it's dramatically shown in the exhibition. But no matter what battle it is, Ramses is always triumphant, and which is not only good for his reputation, of course, but he is an all-powerful king. And it also represents order over chaos. So anytime the king is triumphant, this is what's happening. You're seeing order brought back, or what the Egyptian concept of mat, over chaos. And chaos is characterized by the foreigners. Incidentally, the Hittite version of this battle is somewhat different. It does exist, and I've seen it. And, you know, at most, I guess it was a draw. But ultimately, it ended with a peace treaty, which is very much like our own peace treaties, or, you know, through the years, a kind of non-aggression peace treaty. They won't fight with each other. And furthermore, if either country is attacked, then the other one will come and help them to be victorious. So that was sealed, and there was peace for over 100 years. So, you know, these were two previously, mortal enemies who now have found peace with one another. So there you see him, and he's got the battle axe, and he's about to clobber them. When you see this in person, really notice the color that's still on this block, because it is so vibrant. I mean, you know, and the expressions on the faces of these mortal enemies. Now, this is made out of faience. These are plaques showing these same enemies. And it's not paint, it's faience, which is a ceramic that is made of ground quartz. And so these colors are as bright today as they were when they were created. And, you know, these were images that were found on palace walls and perhaps even on the floors of the palaces. So symbolically, the king would walk over his enemies and subdue them that way. So, as I say, his successes on the battlefield might not always be inclusive or real. How he describes himself may not be accurate, but he is always portrayed as the victor trampling his enemies. And despite these exaggerations that Egypt enjoyed regional military superiority and security under his leadership and prospered. So it's a good time. He is securing their borders. Gold is coming up from Nubia. Gold is coming from the eastern deserts. It's a wealthy time. And I know it's just a time when building and the beautiful jewelry that I'll be showing you is being created throughout Egypt. And there is a substantial period of peace as he continues to secure the borders. The tomb of Ramses the Great was plundered in antiquity, and through the eons there were flash floods that created the streams of flood and brought down rocks and stones into his tomb. And so the exhibition that that we have in San Francisco has incredible works of art that show what a royal tomb would have included. Probably a lot of you have seen the King Tut exhibitions, but these are objects from other royal tombs from before Ramses and then after him. And you have examples of these beautiful, stunning broad collars, pectorals, necklaces, armlets, earrings, sandals, gold sandals, and so on. You know, men as well as women were wearing all of these gorgeous things. And you get some idea of what Ramses' tomb would have included. And, you know, it represents the extraordinary sophistication and cosmopolitan nature of Egyptians and the Egyptian New Kingdom Empire. And as I say, we have Middle Kingdom necklaces like this from around, 2000 to about 1600 BC, and then from a later period of from about 1000 to 700 BC. But it tells you something about the fabulous wealth of the pharaohs and the extravagance of their burials. I mean, the workmanship is just gorgeous. The choice of colors has, again, to do with symbolism. And on each end, you see a falcon head, Horus, perhaps, and just absolutely gorgeous works of art in the exhibition. All right, here's an example from the later period, and it is a massive necklace. It weighs about 18 pounds, and it is solid gold. It was known as the Gold of Honor, and it was a tradition that was handed down from about 1,000 years earlier of the king giving such a necklace to a worthy a military officer or somebody who has done something really important for the Egyptians. And you can see it has, actually it would have been worn the other way around. You get the coils on the front, and where the tassels are, this goes down your back so that you're balanced. I mean, however heavy it is, you're balanced. And it's from a mummy, King Susenes the First, who reigned in the 21st dynasty and dates to about 1000 BC. And it's in perfect condition because gold doesn't, you know, nothing happens to gold throughout the eons. And as I say, it's a tradition that continues through Egyptian history. But here it's on a king, so it's likely thought that the god gave it to the king. And again, that was found in this tomb complex in Tanis, and so was this ewer that is absolutely beautiful. And it comes from about 300 or 400 years after Ramses, the tomb does, but it was an heirloom. And it says in the cartouche, the name of Akhmos, the first pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. And so it was earlier than Ramses, who reigned in the 19th dynasty. But here it was found in a 21st dynasty tomb, so telling us that this was an heirloom that was precious and was brought into the tomb for the next world. And it's just made out of sheets of gold, and it really is gorgeous. So as I say, gold was plentiful. Silver was not. And this is a silver coffin that held the mummy of Sheshonk II. And he was a king from Dynasty 22. And that his tomb was found in the same complex in Tanis. And the coffin is made out of solid silver. And it has the model head of a hawk, which might represent Horus, the god Horus, or Osiris Sokar, who also has a falcon head. And he was the god of the underworld and a funerary god. So this coffin was far rarer than one made of solid gold would have been at that time and would have been quite expensive. So these tombs, this complex of tombs that were found in Tanis, were also robbed in antiquity, but not as much. And so much of the original content was still there. And the objects in the exhibition are magnificent treasures with precious jewelry and coffins. They were found in a complex of 9 tombs put together. And I suspect that had it not been discovered in 1939 during World War II, that this discovery would have been as much an event, as much as happening as the discovery of King Tut's tomb. Well, quickly then, moving on, most Egyptian gods have an animal form or one sacred to them, and prayers that you would make through these animals honored the gods while you're requesting their help and favor. And these were divine offerings because they represented the gods, and kind of this was the god who would then help you with your prayer and rituals. And so these animals were sacrificed to the gods, and then they were mummified the same way humans were mummified, and then they were buried in catacombs. And these are never before seen outside of Egypt because these are recent discoveries just made within the past couple of years. And you have, for example, the cat mummies, which were sacred to the god Bastis. And thousands of cats were mummified and offered to her. And then there are lion cubs, there's a mongoose, there's a crocodile. You'll see a wide variety of animals that were mummified and placed in the catacombs and dedicated to the different gods. Down below, you see a box that has the dung beetle on it, and that is also symbolic, because as the dung beetle pushes a sphere of dung across the sand, so the sun was thought to be pushed by a beetle, a dung beetle, a heifer beetle, across the heavens. So that, you know, has hundreds of mummified dung beetles in it. So it turns out that Saqqara was a center for animal mummy burials, and further excavations, the archaeologists feel, might prove that it holds over, believe it or not, 15 million animal mummies. Well, this is one of the most beautiful things in the exhibition. It tells you something about the people who were the builders and the artists of the Valley of the Kings, the royal tombs. And in a dramatically darkened gallery, you'll see this beautiful sarcophagus which held the coffin and the mummy of the artist Senecem. And it comes from a place called Deir el-Medina, which was the home of workers who excavated in, you know, the Valley of the Kings during the 18th and 20th dynasty. And Senecem was an exceptional artist. We know his name. We know where he worked. And he decorated the tombs of both Ramses the Great and his father, Seti the First. And on this sarcophagus, in the exhibition, you can see photographically the walls of his tomb. So it's as if you walked into his tomb, and in the center of the tomb is his sarcophagus holding the coffin and the mummy. The mummy is not with us in the exhibition, but it originally was there. And it is the most beautiful for a non-royal. Not surprisingly, because on his days off, and we know which days they had off, he could work on his own tomb. Looking at it, you'll see on the left-hand side below, there is the Anubis, who is taking care of Senecem's mummy in the coffin, and you'll see Senecem and his wife playing a game of Senet, which was a board game that kind of symbolizes the route that you would take to get to the afterworld. So it is a marvelous thing. And take a good long look at it, because it really is beautiful. I just put this on. I thought maybe you'd like to see what the artists did in their spare time. Sometimes they practice some of the actual canonical imagery. And on these flakes of limestone, there was a lot of limestone, because they dug into the limestone itself to create the tombs. And in this case, the artist has painted a cat standing upright, and he's herding a group of geese. Very cute, very sweet. But it's a topsy-turvy world. I mean, you know, he's holding a basket on a stick, and he has another stick on it in his raised paw. And, you know, it's a caricature, isn't it? It reflects how the Egyptian artist, especially the artists at Deir el-Medina, where they lived in a walled city, how they expressed their sentiments about absurdities and the faults of society. Usually a cat would run after geese, right? And in this case, he's herding it. And it's very interesting, because there was a period of political tensions and a problem with the economy. And the artisans of Deir el-Medina went on strike a couple of times. That's the oldest strike that we know of in history, because they hadn't received the food and other supplies. That was their salary. So just thought I'd show you that because I love it. As I say, Ramses had about 100 children, and he outlived his wives, many of his wives, and the first 12 of his sons. And here you have a statue of Merenptah, his heir and 13th son. And this is in the exhibition as well. It was found in Merenptah's Theban funerary temple, and he wears a striped Nemes headcloth and with a uraeus. I mean, he's the king, and it's good to be the king. And it's an idealized image, obviously, because, you know, when he became the king, just think about it, he would have been in his 60s. Not as old as King Charles, but in his 60s, but we're looking at him as a young man. Ramses left great memorials to himself all over Egypt, and everything he did was bigger and better than any other. The temples he erected, the statues he commissioned, the monuments he inscribed, and the funerary temple and royal tomb that he built all tell us something about Ramses the Great's life and the world he lived in. And his legacy throughout history is so great that he forms the basis for Percy Bysshe Shelley's poem about the transient nature of earthly power. And here you see, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." This is where the poet is paraphrasing an inscription on the base of one of Ramses' sculptures, which originally stood in the Ramesseum, and you can see the drawing of the fallen sculpture. And, you know, it tells something about the transient nature of whatever you did on earth. And, you know, he passes on. And for the Egyptians, he's still alive. He's still living as a god with the gods. But we look upon what he has done, and we say, well, what really is left? You know, we can look upon the all of the great things that Ramses has left us here, the Ramesseum. And try to be so dramatic and I can't get the slide. The exhibition ends with this colossal statue of the king. And it is a beautiful, it's installed high up as it would have been a colossal statue of Ramses the Great. Now, other kings before and after Ramses erected colossal statues of themselves, but none are larger in size or greater in number than the ones commissioned by Ramses the Great. His sculpture on sacred temple grounds throughout Egypt and Nubia reminded his earthly might to all who came there, but also his closeness to the gods. They thought of him as a god, and as I say, when he died, he continued to be a god. And the exhibition ends with this statue, which, what can I say, he ruled almost as long as Elizabeth II. So I've only been able to show you just a glimpse of the glorious things in this exhibition. And, you know, I invite you all to come and see it. It's there until February 12th. There is time to see it. And I think the way it's installed really gives you a good context, a good understanding of Ramses and his time. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was a great tour, mini tour, of the De Young Museum's exhibition. And there were a lot of little tidbits in there, and I won't go into all of them. Those of you who heard her mention the board game Senet, if you want to play the board game Senet, right outside the Rosicrucian Museum in San Jose, they have a big board, like those big chess boards outside ones, where you can play Senet, just in case you want to learn how to get to the afterlife. In addition to that, you found out how Ramses became a god. Now, our next speaker, Rita Lucarelli, is an Egyptologist at the University of California, Berkeley. She's a specialist in many areas of Egyptology, but also she did her research on the Book of the Dead, and she's going to be speaking to us about becoming a god. We're not recommending this, but we do have a different recommendation, which is if you come here looking for, you know, not becoming a god, but making some advertising money, if you could do a YouTube video of that cat herding the geese that she likes so much, you could probably get several million views. So if you have any questions, we have cards and pencils, so ask. So we'll have a Q&A at the end of Rita's talk, and both Renee and Rita will answer questions. So I'll hand out those cards while Rita begins to speak. Thank you very much for coming, Rita.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Good evening. But I'm really happy to speak right after Renee and the way she talk, speaking indeed about what is left of Ramses II and how those beautiful monuments speak of the king as... monuments present the king as an eternal individual, not just human, but also divine. And indeed, all those beautiful statues, jewelry, most of the artifacts that we found in Egypt come from tombs. And you probably know that the general idea about the ancient Egyptians is that they were obsessed by death. And this is why they filled the tombs with all these beautiful objects and artifacts, and they were painting their tombs. And they were having a lot of magical objects, what we call funerary equipment, in the tomb. So I'll try to explain to you why they were doing that, and if we can really speak about an obsession for death, or maybe an obsession for life, because what they depict for their world in the afterlife, in what they call duat, is a word that we don't know how to translate. Generally, we translate it as the netherworld. So all what we find in the tomb actually speaks a lot about their religious belief and religious practices also during their life on Earth. And this statue you see, is also part of the exhibition in the Young Museum, and it represents the king kneeling and offering a little shrine. Here. And this is the side view, but that shrine has three statues of three divine figures, the god Ra, the god Amun, the Eden god, and a figure of a child. And we have in Egypt a lot of children, child gods. Children's represented also as hieroglyph for to be born, Mes. And actually, so this shrine that Ramses is offering is a rebus of his name, Rames Meriamun, born by Ra and loved by Amun. So with this emphasis on the favor of the god for him. And by the way, the statue has been found in this cachet, a sort of statues hoard in Karnak, where they found 800 statues from all period, from the 3rd millennium BC to the Greek-Roman period. And those were statues that were amassed there later during the pharaonic period. So we found these statues as well. And here the king is very human, is kneeling. We see here just the left leg under his body. The other leg is extended, so he's in a position of kneeling, offering to the gods, worshipping the gods. And indeed, if we think about what is religion for the ancient Egyptian, we realize that, first of all, there's not one word in the ancient Egyptian language for religion, something that we can translate as religion. Religio is Latin, is a different context than what the Egyptians talked about was religion. And the expression that says more about what religion was for there was iret hihet, doing things. What were these things? Those were rituals. So doing ritual things, offering to the gods, taking care of their sacred places and of their deceased. That was religion. So it was really more an action than just a belief. And we see that all the time in the representations in tombs, on objects in tombs, but also in temples, and not only at the royal level, but also at the non-royal level. And indeed, as George said, my specialty is to work with magical text and illustrations taken from the so-called ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead. And this is an example, it's a detail from a papyrus from the Book of the Dead. In those papyri, we always see in the deceased, here is this beautiful woman that again is kneeling, similar to what Ramses was doing, in front of divine figure. In this case, we see a baboon. The baboon is a sacred animal, sacred to the god Thoth, the god of writing, but also the baboon symbolized the worship towards the sun god. Baboons were worshipping the sun, and we will see more baboons later. In this case, this baboon is also worshipping a solar disk, and inside the solar disk there is an amuletic figure, the Eye of Horus, that you have seen also already on this beautiful bracelet that René showed to you. And those symbols of protection, those amuletic figures, are also everywhere on those objects, in tombs, in papyri, but also on tomb walls, because protection was a key concept for life after death for the ancient Egyptians. And their idea of death was indeed a new beginning. I always like to say death is actually a new beginning, is a new life for the ancient Egyptians. And their focus wasn't just about reaching a spiritual life, as we can think about the life of the soul after death, leaving the body and the body decomposing while the soul will survive. Actually, when we look at the Egyptian objects and images, we can see how their focus was also on the body. And this focus on the body also shows that the concept of bodily sustenance, and it was very important. So the body needs to be intact, and this explains, of course, mummification. And it has to be intact and protected in order for the spiritual parts of the deceased to transform into a god. And this is why my title, Becoming a God, which is also an expression, Keper Nature, in ancient Egyptians, that you find in many magical texts, that there is this wish to be transformed in something else, not only again, at the royal level. So not only Ramses was going to be a god, but each individual who could access this sacred knowledge. And so we of course, those papyri belong always to the elite of the society, but we found also artifacts and other proof that those beliefs were shared also with the common people. Only they had no means to really have those beautifully illustrated papyri. And so let's look first of all at the bodily dimension in the ancient Egyptian religious beliefs and how the body moved in the netherworld. And I always like to start from language, because language really helps a lot to understand the way of thinking, right, of the ancient people. And so the Egyptians had two words to define the body. One is khat, that you see represented here on with these hieroglyphs of a fish. And so khat is the corpse. The corpse, though, is not seen as just being in the tomb. The corpse can also descend in the underworld or go in the netherworld. So it can move as well. There is another word, which is sah, and that is the real mummified body, so the corpse after mummification. And it's interesting that the same word is used in some text to indicate someone who is worthy, or in certain translations even use the word aristocrat, because indeed to be mummified was already a privilege. And indeed, not everyone could afford mummifications. We know, though, that there were also natural ways to mummify bodies. So we found also poorer mummified bodies that, anyway, the Egyptians believed could access the netherworld. And the text that you see on the screen is an ancient Egyptian religious text that say, indeed, one shall cut off a foreleg for your ka and a heart for your mummy. May your ba send, may your corpse descend. What that means, the foreleg is the typical offering to the gods or to the dead. And so the ka, we will see what the ka and the ba are exactly, but it's interesting how the mummified body itself, and so not the spiritual part of the individual, but the mummified part needs to be sustained by offerings. And we will see the ba is this human-headed bird, we will see it in a minute, but the corpse, you see, descend. So the corpse enter the netherworld. The corpse of humankind, but of human individual, but also the corpse of the gods. And we see this in these amazing illustrations, very enigmatic as well, a bit esoteric, I will say, of the so-called books of the netherworld. And I will show you some more pictures from the so-called books of the netherworld that were decorating royal tombs, but were used also later for papyri of non-royal individuals. And in this in particular so-called Book of Caverns, we see indeed the mummified body of Osiris in the shrine here. And Osiris was the mummy par excellence, the symbol of the mummified body and of the person that dies and then is reborn. Around Osiris, we see those ovals, which are caverns. We know it from the text. Inside the caverns, we find all those corpse, they are defined in the text as corpse of deities. And it looks always when we see this corpse that they were all kind of isolated. This isolation and this idea of death as isolation and separation is not to be seen as something negative. Isolation was also sort of synonym of protection. So by encircling a body, you isolate it, you protect it. It's the same conception of having temples with walls around to, in order to isolate and protect the ritual sacred space. And so death as bodily separation and isolation is a concept that you really see in images and text a lot, in tombs, in religious and magical texts. And Jan Asman, a very popular, famous and great inspiration for Egyptologists, he's an Egyptologist and an historian, he actually talked a lot about this concept. And by the way, this nice snake on the side here is a guardian, and snakes were very much represented in those books of the Netherworld as chthonic creatures of the earth, and they were acting indeed as guardians of those regions where the bodies of the gods and of the deceased were living and starting a journey. And we will return on the concept of the journey soon.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So as I said, the idea of the mummified body being protected is very present. And this is a beautiful scene from the tomb of Nefertari, the great wife of Ramses II, and one of the most beautiful tombs that we have in the Valley of the Queen, near Valley of the Kings in Luxor. And indeed, as René mentioned, we don't have the tomb of Ramses II is not been preserved properly because of the terrain conditions, but was decorated very similarly to the tombs I'm going to show you, in particular the one of Nefertari. And so what we see here again is a sort of isolated but protected mummified body of Osiris again, and the two goddesses, Nephthys and Isis, sister and wife, two sisters of Osiris, but Isis being also the wife of Osiris, protecting the body in a form of an oak. And those manifestation of gods as animals, of hybrid body, are very common as well. So God could manifest entirely human. In this case, we have the example of the god Nun. We recognize it because of the blue body. Nun was the primordial waters and is indeed a primordial god appearing in many myths. And we have a phoenix bird, also very sacred birds, a lion here that, well, this is the scene that accompany another Book of the Dead spell, chapter 17 of the Book of the Dead, where the all mysteries of Osiris are illustrated and mentioned. And so there is a series of gods, and the lion is one of them, representing also the concept of time, yesterday and today. So speaking about, again, bodies, mummified bodies, bodies of the gods, we have a lot of hybrid bodies as well in the netherworld. They are all protectors, and I like to call them guardians. In ancient Egyptians, they appears as groups of non-individualized, not much individualized guardians with common names like watchers or murderers or wanderers or squatting one. And I think the squatting ones could be this one on this sarcophagus in the upper register. You see, they seems like a bit squatting, but also in this detail from a later coffin, they are still sitting or squatting, and they have animal head and mummified body. And so those were the agents of protection. They have also epithets or sort of names sometimes attached to them that individualize them better, especially in the Book of the Dead. And those are some of the names, as you can see, face downwards, numerous of shapes, or the hearer, said of voice, one who stretch out his brow, or one with vigilant face, the radiant one. So the names always refer in the end to a part of their bodies, and you see them represented here again with those mummified bodies and either some kind of human head or animal head. Animals are always some lions or vultures. Well, there are different kind of wild animals, let's say. In this case, I think this is an hare. It's not always too easy to recognize them. And as you can see here, they hold knives. The attribute of the knife is an attribute of protection. They can also implicitly be dangerous, because if you don't know how to approach them, if you don't know the magical spell that is generally inscribed near their image, you cannot enter the regions that they watch, that they guard. And those regions indeed are distinguished by gates. They generally sit in the gates. And those guardians can be called demons, not in the pejorative sense of the term, not a demon connected to Satan or the devil, but in the Greek sense, as daimon, as a spirit that can be benevolent or malevolent. And indeed, in ancient Egypt, there was not a real dichotomy between evil and good, but the two aspects can go together. So in this case, the guardians indeed were ambiguous beings that the deceased wanted to use for protecting his coffin, his tomb, or that he has to meet in the netherworld. And in this papyrus of the Book of the Dead, as you can see, they are only sketched, but we have also very colorful, beautiful guardians. One of my favorites is actually this female lioness guardian that comes, actually is one of those guardians of the so-called spell 144 of the Book of the Dead. This spell is also illustrated in the tomb of Nefertari, and so maybe you recognize together in a triad. A lot of times those guardian appears in triad, in groups of three. So here we see one with a ram head and a human one. And you see what you see here is one of those gates that the deceased has to enter, and before entering he or she has to speak with the guardians. And so those images are depicted in royal tombs, but also in non-royal tombs. And so the Book of the Dead or the books of the Netherworlds weren't only made for the benefit of royal people. Although we will see at the very beginning, we found those texts only attested in royal tombs, but later they become more popular. And another piece from the exhibition, one of my favorites as well, is this relief fragment representing deities protecting the pharaoh. Where is the pharaoh here? Because we see on the right, you see here Anubis. Well, maybe I'll just move. So Anubis, a very famous god of the dead, taking care of mummification. And the female goddess with the horns and the solar disk could be Hathor, but we see on the text she's Aset Weret, Nechermut, the great Isis, mother of the gods. So this is Isis. And then a mummified figure representing Osiris, but maybe also the pharaoh. But the fact that Ramses II is there is clear from the long cartouche inside which we see the throne name and the bird name of Ramses. So a long cartouche, and the name represents indeed the person. So having the name in between figures of the gods is like actually being there. And so, again, here we see how those necheru, that's the Egyptian word to define the gods, were protecting not only the dead, but also the dead pharaoh. And so this is why in the tombs we find a lot of images where the pharaoh, the queen, are in the presence of the gods. And this is, again, from the tomb of Nefertari. Yeah, so the beautiful queen, as you can see, the headrest is in the shape of a vulture, also a symbol of royalty. And she's here in front of Thoth. Thoth is the god of writing. But this scene really refers to a specific spell of the Book of the Dead, so-called spell 94. We give numbers. The Egyptians didn't give numbers, but because we have to catalog as scholars, we use these numbers. So spell 94 is entitled "The Formula for Requesting the Writing Palette and Water Well for Thoth." And you see here the water well and the palette. Thoth, god of writing, in front of the queen. And this cute frog is actually a symbol of eternity. The frog in ancient Egypt was seen also as divine and symbol of eternity. But this scene also really symbolized the fact that sacred knowledge comes from the gods. Gods are the authors of the text. So we never find text or images signed by the Egyptian artist, but we always have reference to the fact that these words were sacred words. So in order to gain this knowledge, one has to be close to the gods. And this is why religion was so important, because even just the writing, not only religious writing, came from the gods. And so you have to be close to the gods in order to access any formal knowledge. And another important concept, René also mentioned it, is the concept of Maat. Maat is a goddess, beautiful goddess, as you can see, this winged goddess here again from the tomb of Nefertari. She's also the symbol of the concept of truth or justice, or with another expression, whatever is right. What is right, which is not the same. What was right in ancient Egypt is not the same as what is right today, right? So I like this translation, Maat, as what is right for the ancient Egyptians. And Maat was not only important in life on earth, but also in the life in the netherworld. And that's why we have a lot of images with Maat being there, again, as a protected deity, but at the same time, with the need to respect Maat in the netherworld. And I'll show you another picture later. And here are other images of the same period of Ramses II as Ramses I here, was a wonderfully decorated tomb in King Valley 16, where again you see here the pharaoh who is offering, again, doing things, so religion as performance, is offering to a god with a beetle head. And the beetle is also a symbol of becoming, of transformation. And this is indeed an image of the sun god as Khepri, the god of transformation. The other three gods in this nice pose on the back are the so-called Sol, is a translation, but is actually Bao of Ne and Pe and Nehen, two ancient cultic plays, and so gods that follow always the deceased king when approaching other main gods. You can see it in these other scenes here, the pharaoh happily holding hands with a series of very important gods, Horus, the falcon god, son of Osiris, Atum. We know all that, of course, from the name. Atum is another form of the sun god, is the creator sun god. And here we see Hathor. And they are approaching Osiris, the lord of the dead. And this little figure is actually a priest. And we recognize priest because of the leopard skin that they wear. So in always this idea of having the dead in the company of the gods, because indeed in the end what he wants to be is a god himself. So it's important to always stay close with the gods, and that's why we find these decorations in tombs. Here are another beautiful images, and I'll give credits for all these beautiful pictures in a moment, but you see here part of the sarcophagus, anthropoid sarcophagus of Ramses VI in his tomb. That's another beautifully illustrated tomb with figures protecting almost the three-dimensional sarcophagus. This was a great big stone sarcophagus who was smashed in pieces, but thanks to a project supported by actually the American Research Center in Egypt, which I'm part, it was then recomposed and is now in the tomb. It was smashed because they were looking for the gold mask and the other coffins inside it. But even when you enter an Egyptian tomb, you really have this feeling of being protected by from all these figures around you. And so the coffin, the body of the king in the middle, protected by the figures, was considered as a very powerful mean in order to survive in the other world. And so it was no, for them it wasn't important that those tombs were closed and nobody would look at this beautiful art, because the meaning of the function of this art was just magical. So there was not the idea of, oh, somebody has to see what a beautiful piece of art I did in the tomb. The tomb should have been closed. Of course, they've been open pretty soon already in antiquity. And so speaking about the conception of the deceased person, another important idea is that one of the ka, the life force. It's the ka is also hieroglyph of the hands, standing hands, again in action, in a performance for worshipping. And we found statues of ka, like this very famous one in wood from a previous king, Harawi Bra, 13 dynasty, as you can see, much earlier than the time of Ramses. But recently, in 2019, they just discovered this beautiful pink granite statue of the ka of Ramses II. So any deceased must have a ka, because the ka was the life force. and the life source. It was a sort also of double of the deceased, and those statues were placed at the entrance of the tomb where the offerings were brought. So the ka was the part of the dead who should receive the offerings. And these images of the dead receiving offering are... also very popular. This is another piece, painted linen clothes of St. Nefer that you can now also see at the Young. And so the image of the deceased looking like actually much lively man. So again, the body sustained by the offerings on the offering table. The other important part of the deceased was the ba, I already mentioned, generally translated as soul, but I don't like to translate it as soul because indeed it's a different conception. The ba as a body, this body is always very well characterized because it's a bird with the head of the deceased. And you can see they are very careful to make sure that they resemble each other. So here is the deceased in front of his ba. We even have a text from ancient Egypt. It's called The Dialogue of a Man with His Ba, where we have a man trying to convince the ba that actually life is not good and he wants to die. And it's actually considered one of the most ancient texts about thinking about suicide. And we don't know how it ends the text, but the ba is actively talking with the man and saying how he should enjoy life on earth. And it's a beautiful text actually to read, a piece of literature from ancient Egypt. And of course, I wanted to show you the beautiful ba of Queen Nefertari. As you can see, it's the same face of the queen that here is indeed playing Senet. The chess game in ancient Egypt represented, again, this is a vignette from the Book of the Dead of spell 17, playing Senet. Senet means passing. So playing Senet is trying to pass through the netherworld. And here the ba is on top of the tomb, because the ba was the element of the person who could leave the tomb, go around in the world of the livings, but he always says to go back and reunite to the body. So I cannot just leave and have fun forever on earth. It needs to go back to the tomb. And apparently from the images, it looks he was always doing that. And we have also ba of the gods. In this case, we see another of these books of the netherworld, a very interesting one from the tomb of Ramses VI, the Book of Caverns. And you see here an ithyphallic form of Osiris with this little bird on the on his head. And so this is actually the baldo. It doesn't have the face of Osiris. And again, you see here Osiris that is approaching another region of the netherworld. There is a snake, another guardian snake, this oval representing sarcophagi or caverns. And here, probably you may ask yourself, what about these bodies? As you can see, they have no head, they are decapitated, and their arms are tied behind their back. And this is the iconography indeed of the captive that we have seen also in some of the pieces of René's presentations. But this iconography was also then associated to the damned. The damned people, those who don't pass the final judgment and cannot become gods. They are punished forever, and they are represented in this sort of Egyptian hell, in this calderon, in what is called in the text place of annihilation. And you see this place has hands, and those hands are holding the calderon. So this is... better than Dante's Divina Commedia, I guess. Finally, another important part of the person appearing in funerary composition is the Akh. Akh is a word in ancient Egyptian that means to be effective. And indeed, the Akh is the effective spirit, is the, also the transfigured spirit. After becoming a god, you become an Akh. And ancestors are considered Aku as well. So we have those beautiful stela called Akeniker stela, the stela of the very worthy Akh. The Akh here is really the deceased ancestor. Those parts of the person, Ba, Ka, Akh, occurs in tomb, papyri decorations, within a narrative of a journey, the journey through those regions of the netherworld. And indeed, the real title of the Book of the Dead, the Book of the Dead is what Egyptologists called this collection of spells. The first title was indeed the German Totem Book, and then became known as Book of the Dead. But in the Egyptians call it Peretem Heru, going out by day or going out in the light. And so in these images, we always see the deceased in form of Ba, or as a human being coming out of the tomb and then moving back, so starting this journey. When we see this idea, this belief in the journey, very early, already in pre-dynastic period, before having even text attested, in the burials of the so-called Nakada period, this is a reconstruction, we can see the human body surrounded by vases, and many of them are decorated. And this is the decoration of the image of a boat. So the idea of traveling by boat in a journey, and those boats don't only go on water, but also in the sky, is present even before writing started. So we are talking here about 3600 BC. Starting from a bit later, 3000 BC, we start to have some text in the pyramids of the king, and texts like, indeed, "Hail to you, ostrich, which is on the bank of the winding waterway, open my way that I may pass." This sort of text stayed the same until the first millennium BC and later. "Open the way, let me pass." It's like the real obsession of the ancient Egyptians was not about death, but about being able to move in the netherworld. And so the first texts are carved in the burial chamber of the kings of the so-called Old Kingdom. So we are around 2400 BC. You see beautifully carved, also colored. And here you see the cartouche of Unis, that is a king of the fifth dynasty, the first one with the text engraved in the tomb. And this is when we say, well, those texts were only for the kings, but probably they were also used by non-royal persons, only not inscribed in those beautiful tombs. Later on in the second millennium BC, the same texts are edited and copied on coffins. And those are those wooden coffin, completely inscribed, especially inside. Why inside and not more inside than outside? Outside there were just line of text with offering formulas, but inside there were all the spells. So why inside? Because the deceased will wake up probably and look around and start to have this secret knowledge to read around, know how to move in the netherworld. And indeed, this is the period also when we have the first maps of the netherworld, the so-called Book of the Two Ways, inscribed on the bottom or inside those wooden coffins, rectangular coffins. You can see, maybe you can see here why it's called the Book of the Two Ways. There are mainly two different ways made of water and fire through which the deceased has to go during this journey, and recognizing all the divine creatures he meets during the journey. And so those rectangular coffins are found also later, although later on at the time of Ramses, coffins were mostly anthropoid, but there was a system of nest coffins. So the anthropoid coffins in the end were placed inside a bigger outer coffin that could be rectangular coffins like the coffin of Senegem that you have already seen. And of course, I wanted to show you the detail of the bath of Senegem and his wife, which are really beautiful. And as René said, it's amazing how this coffin has been placed now in the exhibition of Ramses the Great, because the old tomb is reconstructed. And once you're there, you can see how, if you look at the images of the outer coffins, which are again spells of the Book of the Dead, you'll see that some of them are the same from the tomb wall. So some of the images, we don't know if it was Senegem who chose those. We think so, because he was an artisan, and so he was himself decorating tombs. Some of those scenes he talked were probably very important, and so wanted to have them both on tomb walls and on coffins. And another beautiful scene from this tomb here in a facsimile is the one of the so-called Egyptian paradise. We have seen a sort of hell, but there was also paradise, and this looked as a very abundant place where the deceased, though, and his wife, very often, like in the case of Senegem, were working. And why you would work in the netherworld, like here occupied, as you see, in field work with grain, moving here, bringing, yeah, the cattle, and you can see then also, anyway, honoring the gods. Why doing that? Well, it was a way to express the fact that life in the netherworld was actually the same as on Earth, and actually the wish was for having even a wealthier life than on Earth. And working in the field, it means that you have those fields, right? So you're a rich person in the netherworld. Again, going back to the books of the netherworld, I wanted to show you this image from actually a shrine. So we have seen papyri tomb walls, but even those shrines of important kings, and in this case, this is the shrine of Tutankhamun, were decorated with very magical protective images. And so you see here this this very peculiar one where you see again this mummified body with what is the oldest representation of the Ouroboros, the encircling snake representing beginning and end of time. And those are really enigmatic pictures, because the text doesn't say much about it. So what we think is indeed that this was an union of actually the sun and Osiris, meaning rebirth. And you see also those images of gods who are with the rope, kind of extracting another solar disk, with the ram-headed bird with human hands inside. So there's a lot there for creativity, and there have been so many interpretations also of these images. And I think there will be many more, because they were left ambiguous for a purpose, I think, and because in ancient Egyptian religions, they weren't really strong concepts about what is good or what is bad, what is a symbol of death or life, but everything was connected in many different ways. So they wanted to leave also some room for interpretations. And to conclude, the Amduat, that means what is in the Duat, what is in the netherworld, is another important composition. attested in royal tombs and then non-royal papyri in the Ramesside period. And this composition is divided in 12 hours of the night, illustrating the journey of the sun god, considering the royal king, the deceased king being the sun god as well. And so here you will see the sun god always represented here in one boat and with an encircling in a shrine, and here as a scarab, as a beetle again. And all those gods, they were all inhabitants of the netherworld. There is a long series of hybrid bodies. You see here we have Stila with the human head. Those were all following the journey of the sunboat, and they were living there. So the netherworld was highly populated. They must have had a house issue as well, like in the Bay Area. I guess less expensive than here, but... you can see here more of those bodies following in a detail from the second hour. The second hour is especially a watery region, so we have all this water going around, and more protective deities, sketches with some text on it saying about the names. Also here in captions. And these are tomb walls, but they are treated almost like if they are a papyrus. You can see it especially from... this part. You see, this is still a tomb wall, but looks like a papyrus, and probably they had the papyrus. They were copying from the papyrus, writing all this text, explaining what was going on in the netherworld. And so in the end, I don't have time to show you all the hours, but the 12 hours is the moment in which the solar boat goes out from the underworld and goes back in the sky. So after having met with the body of Osiris. Okay. And this we find it also on sarcophagi. And I really have to credit for most of these beautiful photos this book, Bilder den Usterblickheit, a German publication, cured by Zachia Was, with the photos of an Italian photographer, Sandro Vannini, who spent many years taking beautiful pictures in the Valley of the Kings, and you can find a lot of his photos also on internet, on Flickr, for instance. And if you want to look at more of those images, I have a digital project with the Hearst Museum of Anthropology at UC Berkeley, and indeed we have an Egyptian collection too, only we don't have space for... we don't have gallery space, so with this project I'm digitizing coffins decorated with Book of the Dead and spells and images. And so if you want to have a look, self-promotion here, you can go on the website and look at more images. What you have seen of those beautiful tomb images are also on later coffins from the first millennium BC. It was this. So this is one of the coffins I digitized. Actually, we did also a couple of coffins from the Legion of Honor, and they are online, and you can flip around the 3D model, look around all these beautiful images, again, of God's protection of the deceased. And with this, I thank you for your attention. Sorry if I hope I didn't take too much time.
That was great. So before we start the Q&A, we have a poll and a disclaimer. So the poll is, so we have these chairs set up for the Q&A from the side so that it's like Egyptian. Do you want them to sit to the side or do you want them to face? No.
Face.
Okay, great. And the disclaimer is, for those of you who, for one of two reasons, either you don't think that you qualify under the good and evil standard of getting into heaven? Or if you're like not a speciest and you'd prefer to be in a heaven with a lot of other animals, animal heads anyway, so our disclaimer is that Humanities West does not
work together.
You know, will not stand behind the spells that Rita laid out, you know, for getting you into this, because there's a rumor that this heaven, you know, was closed about 2,000 years ago or so, and is no longer active. So you can try it if you want to, but we don't guarantee it. All right, let's do the Q&A. I'm going to start with a couple of questions that came into us from our live stream audience. About 100 people watch this at the same time.
Cool.
Online. So we have a question from Kip Crana, who we all know here. How did the Egyptian concept of the underworld compare with the Western idea of paradise? Was the underworld a place of perpetual happiness?
Yes. So it was, if you've been good on earth and passed the judgment and indeed become a transfigured spirit, then definitely you will end up in this field of offerings that was a sort of paradise. But otherwise, you could be damned forever. So there was this other concept, the mut. The mut is the a sort of, well, it's a pity Halloween is gone already, but a sort of the evil dead, the restless dead. Mut were also considered really dangerous on earth. They could come back and hurt you, like sort of ghost. But they are represented in those scenes of a sort of hellish scenes in which they are punished, and they are punished forever. And there are those gods and guardians who keep punishing them by cutting their head, burning them in fire, drawing them in water. Really, really cruel stuff that was going on in the Egyptian hell.
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to add that many of you know the scene in the Hall of Judgment where the heart is weighed against the feather of truth, the feather of Mot. We talked about Mot. And if your heart was heavy with your evil deeds, then it would be thrown to a demon or destroyer or what was he called?
The devourer of the
devourer
dead.
And then he would a person would be dead forever. However, if your heart was light with good deeds, then you could proceed. And it's a wonderful image because, you know, you've got the balance scale, you've got the concept of Mot, and you have the heart. And you know, when people were mummified, they didn't know where personality came from. They didn't know your memory, what you did. They thought it was the heart. You know, they threw away whatever they found in the skull as just some kind of lining, something. So that way, it was your heart that would tell if you've been good. And of course, one way to make sure you were told what was good is you had a heart scarab that would say something like, "Oh, my heart, do not speak against me in the Hall of Judgment." So you were protected in one way or another.
Yeah, in this papyri, if I may add, the poor devourer of the dead, Amemet, which was this composite monster, with the body of a lion, a hippo, will stay hungry forever because all those deceased, of course, passed the judgment. They had this negative confession in which they say, "I did not commit this and that, I did not lie, I did not steal," and they were always passing the judgment. So I always feel sad for Amemet, the devourer, that could never devour any hurt.
No.
So here's one for Renee. The exhibit at the De Young is excellent. Thank you for bringing it to San Francisco. How many have been there? We'll ask. We'll cheer it on. It's really fantastic. And then the question is, how did you arrange to get it here instead of it going to another city?
You know, I mentioned that the exhibition in Egypt was organized by Zahi Hawass. You all know him, a very fine archaeologist. He's on National Geographic, Discovery Channel. He's very sure of himself. He's a great self-promoter. And I think it was the New Yorker magazine who referred to him as Zahi the Great. So he, because of his high status in Egypt, he was able to secure these wonderful treasures that came. Once these treasures go back to Egypt, I have to tell you, I don't think you will see them in our lifetime. They'll go back to the museums. The Great Egyptian Museum is being put together right now, and treasures are being put in there. Other museums as well are being redesigned and updated. So this was a kind of once-in-a-lifetime experience. I knew that it was the right thing to do. How did I hear about the exhibition? This is funny. There's a company that worked with Zahi to organize it in America and Europe, and actually it's going to Japan as well. But they said to him, where in America would you like it to go? And I've worked with Zahi on a number of projects throughout the years. I've known him since we were both students. And he said, call Renee. So there you go. So, yeah. But the trick was, you know, I presented it to my director. And I've told you there are a number of different aspects of the exhibition. Images of Ramses the Great, things that relate to Ramses the Great, but then jewelry before and after him, and other things that, like the animal mummies. And my director said, as long as you can make it coherent, as long as you continue, you know, to take this exhibition and make it right for our visitors who are far more sophisticated than in other cities. Then, no, it's true. I've brought you lots of Egyptian exhibitions, so, you know, really, San Francisco knows a lot more. It opened in Houston, Texas, and I had the opportunity to see it there and then reconstituted it for San Francisco. So, you know, it now reads very well as I've presented to you. So, director said, fine.
All right, there's a very detailed question that's kind of interesting. How did Egyptians know about baboons? I think of them as being sub-Saharan deep in the jungles, but obviously it's part of their iconography, so they must have known about them. So
yeah.
Does anybody know? Do you know how they know about them?
Yeah. There were baboons in Egypt when there was also a different climate. And so that's why we find representations of animals that you don't find in Egypt now, like baboons or lions or elephants. Mm-hmm. So they basically, when Egypt was had more green, let's say, as well than now, those animals were brought also from the south, so from Nubia today Sudan, and they were brought then also to northern Egypt. That's why they're known.
And that's how Hannibal got his elephants too. Another one from our online audience. This one's from Jongmin Lee. Did Ramses II try to popularize religion and mystery, than the mystery of Osiris among common people? Do you think he was a good king to the common people?
Oh, that's a good question. Was he a good king for the common people? I think probably that's true. He considered himself the leader of all of the cults of Egypt as the religious person that all would look to. And he set precedence for other people, for the common people as well. And they would see him making the offerings, and they would see him creating these temples to the gods and fixing other temples that had fallen into ruin so that the gods could rule effectively. I think in that way, you know, they would follow him and understand what it meant to worship the gods in the proper way. I think so.
Mm-hmm. There's a related question, so I'm going to read that one too. Do you think the fact that the common people could access the gods means that the pharaohs and elites tried to teach their religious knowledge to people so that they could communicate with them? So did they, you know, we know about how religion operates here. You said basically it's a ritual. It was a ritual in ancient Egypt, a ritual for different purposes. Mm-hmm. So were the poor people tried to be brought into those rituals in any way, or were they ignored? Yeah, I think that's a...
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really the king teaching the people, but were the priests mm-hmm. in the temple were controlling, let's say, the religious life and connected to, of course, politics as well. So those priests were in contact not just with the king, but also with the people. And we used to call personal piety of popular religion the sort of religious practices that do not happen in the temple but in the household. And we have found, especially in Deir Medina, private cults, so cults of house cults of certain deities who do not have temples. So those were cults not to Osiris, Hathor, Anubis, but to deities like Bes, a dwarf god who was considered a very strong protector, especially for pregnant women, or Mesegeret, the cobra goddess of the desert, was considered also a very protective goddess. So there was another dimension to the cult, to the religious life, that did not really go through the king, but was connected to the temple and to the priestly environment. So priests were actually very important for life in ancient Egypt in general.
You know, one thing I just wanted to expand upon, we both talked about Senegem and Deir el-Medina, and the reason why we know so much about what life was like. I mean, you've got discoveries, you know, within this walled city of the actual builders and painters and artisans of the royal tombs is because there are so many texts that they left, and these texts describe a lot of what their life was like. And in fact, not only how they lived, how they worked, and how they worshipped. And it really turns out to be a miraculous way to understand the people. I wouldn't necessarily call them common people because they were an elite group. But it does teach us a lot about, you know, more ordinary people, you know, not the royalty, the non-royals.
One more question from Kip Krana. You just mentioned about all these different gods were, like, for protection purposes. They would protect different groups. What did the kings who went to the underworld need protection from? Why do they need protectors? Why is the underworld so dangerous? Why, you know... Because a lot of the ancient world's ideas had a lot to do with you need to be protected when you go over.
Yeah, because those beings in the netherworld, as I think I mentioned, could also be hostile if you don't know how to approach them, because they were guardians, so they were also guarding those regions. Mm-hmm. And so in order to go through, you really need to know how to address them. So here, this is the sort of secret knowledge, the esoteric knowledge that the deceased needs to to have. And the protection is also at the bodily level. So the protection is the protection, first of all, of the tomb on earth, of the coffin, of the mummified body. And then it continues in the netherworld. But it started actually from the tomb. So it's, first of all, protection of the body, I would say.
Perfect. Here's something that all children ask in whatever religion they are. Is the netherworld or paradise thought of as an imaginary, out-of-reality place, or is it in the sky, or is it a physical place somewhere in the west where the sun sets? You know, I mean, how do they think about this?
It's really a bit everywhere, in the sense that we have those images that speak about a celestial region, a region in the sky, and the boat travels in the sky. And for instance, in the pyramid text, there are spells where it is said that the king is looking for a way to ascend to the sky. And so either there is a stair, or it transforms into smoke. There are different ways to reach the sky. But then we have all these images of an underworld, which is clearly a subterranean world with sands, also course of water, but is the realm of the night. So it's like a journey that starts in the sky with the sun rising in the east, and then and enter the underworld from the west. And the west is also the place connected to the cemetery where the tombs are, because that's where then also the sun god starts to the journey during the night in the underworld to meet with the body of Osiris. So all those images I've been showing, they were all about this journey in the sky and in the underworld.
Well, this is a question for Renee, and we couldn't get through this without this question. Is it true that the story of Moses bringing the Hebrews out of Egypt really happened during the reign of Ramses II?
Well, if you believe Charlton Heston... You know, it's likely to have been actually not Ramses II, but if you figure out when the Israelites were in Egypt, and you know, sometimes you can read the Old Testament as history, you know, that it's more likely to have been Meremta, his son, than Ramses II. But Hollywood made it Ramses. It's around the same time, I would say.
Around the same time. But it's always helpful to have the Pharaoh have the great on his name for a Hollywood movie. It's an extra million tickets sold. So here's a question. I was surprised to learn that Ramses II moved his capital to the Nile Delta. Do we know why then he built Abu Simbel so far away in Upper Egypt? I mean, was he trying to cover the whole? Yeah.
Go Absolutely. He was covering all his bases. and remember where the traditional enemies were to the south. He secured those borders and expanded them. So this was part of his kingdom. But as I say, in the Delta area, that's likely to be the home of all of the Ramses and Setis during that dynasty. But consider also the ability to muster an army if you're fighting up in Syria, for example, or even Libya to the west. Having a secure place up in the north would also protect the country from that, and from the pirates coming from the Mediterranean. So, you know, having these two kingdoms really helps secure the boundaries of Egypt.
Well, of course, thanks for all your great questions, and there's time for just one more. And here's someone who clearly grew up also hedging his bets. Are there only two options in death, paradise or hell, or are there more than two?
I'm feeling a bit like this religious.
You have become the guru of ancient Egyptian ritual, not religion.
Yes. So there wasn't a conception really of what we would call a place in between, a purgatory. Mm-hmm. Not really. So yeah, I will say either you pass the judgment, make sure that the devourer doesn't eat your heart, and become an Akh, a transfigured spirit, or you will stay a damned one and maybe go back on earth trying to bring illness to the living. And we found spell where it is said that the evil dead has been bringing illness. We even have letters to the dead in which individuals write to their dead relatives when those are coming on earth to disturb them. And those are really, indeed, documents that let us know how non-royal people think. And especially there is a very nice one in which, very funny one in which husband writes to the dead wife. Apparently the dead wife was upset and was disturbing him. And he say, "Why you're doing this to me? I've always been good to you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You should forgive me." Basically say something like, "You should, because I've been so good to you, you should forgive me if now I have another woman." So clearly the dead wife was really upset. That's what yeah, right.
I've got to end on that. That's too good. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Our next program is December 2nd. It's going to be on Leonardo da Vinci. And we will hope to see you then.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.